Welcome to the Family Farm Podcast, priority topics for family medicine and community pharmacy. Hi everyone, my name is Tina Lian and I'm a fourth year pharmacy student at the University of British Columbia.
And I'm Billy Lin, I'm a family practice resident at UBC. We're interrupting our coverage of the national guidelines on the most important topics, and we're bringing you the first EBM special on the Family Farm Podcast. In case you're wondering why, well, Tina started her community pharmacy practical rotation recently, and she actually doesn't have any day off this January. We're starting to feel the time crunch for making these podcasts, but don't worry, Tina will try to find time to research around AFib, and we'll bring you the AFib podcast soon.
Yes, I will get that ready soon.
Before we start, we would like to introduce everyone to a few great EBM resources that we like to use. The first is the Independent Watchdog, and a huge influence of mine during med school, the Therapeutics Initiative. They're funded through a government grant to UBC, and the TI letters that they publish are concise summaries of unbiased review of clinical evidence. And more than once, they have correctly pointed out some crucial information about medications on the market. The second is a set of concise, clinically relevant evidence reviews called the Tools for Practice, developed by Dr. Mike Allen, who is an associate professor in family medicine at the University of Alberta. He is also the co-host of one of our favorite podcasts, with Dr. James McCormack, who is a professor at the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at UBC. And the podcast I'm referring to is, of course, the Best Science Medicine Podcast, which provides great EBM information for primary care.
So as we go along, we may pick up some useful resources to share. We will post links to every review mentioned in this podcast on our show notes, and we will list permanent links to resources we have used on our website at fbpodcast.org.
So just as a note of caution, if you're writing a licensing exam, for example, for pharmacy or for the CCFP exam, they're most likely still based on national guidelines summarized earlier. So the evidence-based information presented in these EBM episodes should probably inform our daily practice, but when taking the exams, following the guidelines would probably win you more points, and it would be really difficult to present the evidence and argue with the exam marker.
Now back to this episode, this EBM special is a follow-up to our previous discussion on hypertension. We will summarize a few pieces of evidence that provides a contrasting view from the recommendations in the CHEP 2013 guidelines.
So to start off, we'll talk about salt restriction. So Tina, do you remember what the CHEP guideline 2013 tell us about salt restriction?
Mm-hmm, of course. They recommend 1,500 milligrams, and that's 65 millimoles of sodium per day, for adults age 50 years or less. Now for people age 51 to 70 years of age, the recommendation is 1,300 milligrams per day. And for people greater than 70 years of age, it is 1,200 milligrams per day.
Very well done.
I told you I know what I'm saying.
Okay, in the Tool for Practice published in February of 2013, the efficacy of controlling cardiovascular disease by sodium restriction is reviewed. They looked at a systematic review of 7 RCTs lasting greater than 6 months of duration, which involves a total of more than 6,000 patients, and they found that there's no statistically significant difference in all-cause mortality in either normotensive or hypertensive patients. The relative risk for all-cause mortality is 0.9 and the 0.96 for normotensive and hypertensive patients, respectively. And the 95% confidence interval crosses 1 in both cases. The systematic review also showed that there is non-significant difference in terms of cardiovascular disease events. And in normotensive patients, relative risk is 0.71, and the confidence interval covers 0.42 to 1.2 versus the hypertensive group, and with a RR of 0.84, and is also non-significant. However, the trend is towards the reduced outcomes in all-cause mortality and CVD events. On average, the control group had a sodium intake of about 3,900 milligrams, and the treatment group with salt restriction had a reduced sodium to 3,000 milligrams per day. During my research, sodium intake of about 4,000 milligrams seems to be an average intake in North America. And this systematic review showed that a modest reduction to 3,000 milligrams does have a trend towards reduced outcomes, although the difference is non-significant. You may be wondering if further salt restriction to the guideline recommended levels would lead to a better cardiovascular outcome. However, a study done in 1995 showed a low sodium restriction to less than 2,000 milligrams per day is associated with greater risk for myocardial infarction among males treated for hypertension. Therefore, there appears to be a J-curve distribution in terms of sodium restriction and sodium intake, and that either extremes of sodium intake at greater than 4,000 milligrams and less than 2,000 milligrams, there appears to be increased harm in terms of cardiovascular disease. In terms of reducing blood pressure, which is a surrogate marker for cardiovascular health, the research has been pretty consistent. The more salt restriction that the patient undertakes, the lower the blood pressure it would be. In comparison, very little research has been done to show that sodium restriction can lead to improved patient-oriented outcomes in terms of mortality and morbidity. Some may argue that if salt restriction can reduce blood pressure, then it must follow that the reduction in blood pressure will translate into an improved survival and health. However, that may not necessarily be the case, as is the case with atenolol and aliskiren and other interventions that have been shown to lower blood pressure but not improve mortality. Okay, next topic. In terms of the target for blood pressure management, what's the target for most patients?
Well, I've been waiting for this question. So that's 140 over 90.
Okay. And what is the special patient group that has a different blood pressure target?
So that's for diabetes patients. And the target will be 130 over 80.
Very good.
Thank you.
However, a recent Cochrane review published in October of 2013 looked at whether or not a lower blood pressure target, which is defined as any target around 130 over 85 range, is associated with reduction in mortality and morbidity compared to the standard blood pressure target around 140 over 90 in patients with diabetes. And they found that a lower systolic blood pressure target is associated with a small reduction in the incidence of stroke of an absolute risk reduction of 1.1%, but also associated with a larger increase in the number of other serious adverse events with an absolute risk increase of 2%. And these adverse events include hypotension, syncope, bradycardia or arrhythmia, hyperkalemia, angioedema, and renal failure. The effect of systolic blood pressure targets on mortality was neutral, balancing the reduction and the increase in risk. There is no benefit or harm associated with a lower diastolic blood pressure target, but the trend is towards less stroke with a relative risk of 0.67, which translates into a 33% relative risk reduction if the outcome was statistically significant. However, the 95% confidence interval was 0.42 to 1.05. I thought this relative risk is actually quite convincing, but it's unfortunate that the 95% interval just crosses 1 and making this insignificant statistically. In a related tools for practice published in 2010, they also concluded that a hypertension treatment target of 140 over 90 lowers its risks, but there's inconsistent evidence to support a treatment target of 130 over 80, even in patients with diabetes. Now, moving on.
Yay!
In a patient with uncomplicated hypertension, what is the treatment target?
That will be 140 over 90.
Okay. Yeah, like you said, the treatment target is 140 over 90 for almost everybody, including uncomplicated hypertension. But in a Cochrane review published in 2012, the authors examined 4 RCTs with almost 9,000 participants, and they took a look at the effect of treating hypertension in patients with a systolic blood pressure between 140 and 160 and a diastolic blood pressure between 90 and 100. They found that there's no statistically significant reduction in total mortality with a relative risk of 0.85 and a non-significant increase in coronary heart disease with a relative risk of 1.12. And a non-significant reduction in stroke with a relative risk of 0.51 and a confidence interval of 0.24 to 1.08 and a non-significant effect on cardiovascular events with a relative risk of 0.97. However, there is a statistically significant increase in terms of adverse effects forcing the patients to withdraw from trial, with a relative risk of 4.80, which translates into an absolute risk increase of 9%, meaning that treating patients with mild hypertension versus placebo has a 9% increased chance of causing them to withdraw from this trial due to adverse events. I wanted to point out again that the reduction in stroke is actually almost significant with a relative risk of 0.51, but just the confidence interval crosses 1 again into 1.08. So although technically it's non-significant statistically because the p is not less than 0.05, the p is quite small, and chances are treating this patient population probably does reduce the stroke risk, but there is not enough evidence to support that they reduce mortality or other cardiovascular events. Now, here's something that people should get excited about.
Ooh, okay, what is it?
Well, what are the first-line agents for treating hypertension?
So first-line agents are beta blockers, but this is only first-line for patients under than 60 years of age, ACE inhibitors, ARBs, thiazides, and calcium channel blockers.
All right. Yep, that's correct. That's what the guideline says anyway. And on this topic, there is a very good therapeutics initiative letter that summarizes several interesting Cochrane reviews on this topic. And that's the letter number 82, titled Clinical Hypertension Tutorials from the Cochrane Library. And to summarize their summary, it seems that low-dose thiazides is the first choice. It's better than ACE inhibitors and calcium channel blockers, and everything is better than beta blockers. Although surprisingly, there is no data on ARBs in terms of reducing mortality and morbidity. So let's walk through this slowly and carefully. The first Cochrane review was published in 2009, looking at first-line agents compared to placebo and their effect on mortality, stroke, coronary heart disease, and cardiovascular events. They found that first-line low-dose thiazides reduced mortality with an absolute risk reduction of 1.2% and total cardiovascular events with an absolute reduction of 3.9%. First-line angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors reduced mortality with an absolute risk reduction of 2.3% and total cardiovascular events with an absolute risk reduction of 4.8%. However, the first-line beta blockers only reduces total cardiovascular events with an absolute risk reduction of 0.8%, but not mortality. Similarly, first-line calcium channel blockers reduce total cardiovascular events to an absolute risk reduction of 2.3%, but not mortality either. And they actually did not find a trial that compares the effect of ARB on mortality and morbidity when compared to placebo. Based on this, they concluded that thiazide should be first line because it reduces mortality, stroke, coronary heart disease, and cardiovascular disease events. ACE inhibitors also reduces mortality and morbidity, but the data is from the HOPE trial, which is mostly secondary prevention. Calcium channel blockers are not shown to be statistically significantly reducing mortality, but their effect in reducing morbidity is greater than beta blockers. A limitation of this systematic review is that about 70% of the RCTs for beta blockers used atenolol as their active agent. But based on the available evidence, their conclusion was that first-line low-dose thiazides should be first-line, and ACE inhibitors should be second-line, with calcium channel blockers on the third-line and beta blockers on the fourth-line. The TI letter summarized two other Cochrane reviews, one looking at calcium channel blockers when compared to the other first-line agents, and the other one compared beta blockers to placebo and the other first-line agents. And both reviews arrived at basically the same conclusion, in that thiazide diuretics should be the first-line agent in treating uncomplicated hypertension, followed by ACE inhibitors, calcium channel blockers, and ARBs, and the beta blockers should not be used as first-line agent because of an inferior effect on morbidity compared to other antihypertensives and a lack of statistically significant effect on mortality when compared to placebo. At this point, you might be wondering what is up with ARBs. There is data that shows ARBs is non-inferior to ACE inhibitors in terms of reducing blood pressure. However, as mentioned, blood pressure is a surrogate marker, and there's actually no data that shows ARBs reduces mortality and morbidity compared to placebo. In a review published in Annals of Pharmacotherapy in 2005, concluded that ACE inhibitors and ARBs should not be considered interchangeable, and when using ARBs in patients who is intolerant to ACE inhibitors, one should realize that ARBs have not been shown to prevent MIs or prolong survival. So, seems like the thiazides are the clear winner here. There are two commonly used thiazide diuretics. One is hydrochlorothiazide, and the other is chlorothalidone. In the Tools for Practice published in February of 2012, the authors found that chlorothalidone, with its longer half-life of 50 to 60 hours versus hydrochlorothiazide with a half-life of 9 to 10 hours, appear to have a superior blood pressure control. So thiazides is the first-line antihypertensives, and chlorothalidone is the first-line thiazide. The initial dose is 12.5 milligrams. Okay, one last topic of the night. Is there a preference in what time the patient should take blood pressure medications?
I wonder what that is.
Because CHEP does not have any suggestions about what time to take the blood pressure medication.
Is that so?
But the Tools for Practice published on January 9th in 2012 looked at the MAPEC, MAPEC trial, which is a 5.6-year trial of 2,100 hypertensive patients with a very simple intervention. Taking at least one antihypertensive medications at bedtime versus taking it in the morning. And this is probably the easiest intervention I've ever seen done in any medical trials. The patient is taking the same drug, same doses, just different times. And the result is quite astonishing. They show that there is a statistically significant reduction in mortality and in total cardiovascular disease events. The number needed to treat to decrease mortality is 67, and the number needed to treat for preventing one cardiovascular disease event is actually 9. So that means for every 9 patients who take their blood pressure medications at night instead of in the morning, one of them could prevent a cardiovascular disease event. Although the study does have some limitations, their intervention is so simple and the result is actually so dramatic that I think there is really no good reason for asking the patient not to take their blood pressure medication at night. All right, so that brings us to the end to the current issue of EBM on hypertension. If you have other medical evidence that's clinically relevant, please do send us a line. This is the first EBM episode on hypertension, but I don't expect this to be the last one. We're planning to do more EBM episodes on all the major topics. We haven't decided on what topic to cover with our next episode of Family Farm Podcast, but we will try our best to keep our weekly publication schedule. Before we sign off, we would like to invite those of you who haven't done so to please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. And for those of you who have been to our iTunes page, please leave a comment and leave a rating if you like what we've been doing. That will not only help us reach more audience, you will also make Tina and I feel warm and fuzzy inside. So until next week, thank you for listening.
And we'll talk to you next time.
You've been listening to the Family Farm Podcast. Please leave your feedback and check out our show notes at fppodcast.org.